right, gang, welcome to Money Talks. I'm your host, Bill Barhite. We've got a little bit of a somber Money Talks today. It's been a rough week in the banking industry. Let's see. So we had Silicon Valley Bank has failed. Signature Bank has failed. Silvergate Bank has failed. Credit Suisse is getting a bailout. First Republic is getting backstopped by a few banks to make sure that they can manage withdrawals and that there's no run on the bank. And the FDIC seems to be willing, along with Treasury, to backstop long-term bond losses to the tune of almost $1 trillion, possibly more, actually probably more, probably closer to $2 trillion now. This is by far the worst crisis we've faced in the banking system since the great financial crisis led by the housing market boom and bust of 15 years ago. Yeah, it's been 15 years. And it's scary. So let me explain to you what's happened, why it's happened. Then I'm going to have a friend of mine, Nick Carter, join us. Nick is a prolific in his coverage of what's been going on in the crypto banking space. And because crypto is being mentioned along with these bank failures, mostly inappropriately so, I think it's important to understand what's really going on. No hyperbole, no BS, just what's really going on. All right, so let's dig in. I'm going to start with the bond markets. All right, now, why are we talking about bond markets when banks are failing? Bond markets lead the way when it comes to modern economies. Right. If you want to know where a market's going, follow the bond market. Right. It is the purveyor of truth. Bond prices and bond markets are important for several reasons. Okay. One, they set interest rates. Bond prices and interest rates are basically the same thing. As bond prices increase, interest rates decrease, and vice versa. And interest rates are the critical component of an economy's monetary policy, a centralized monetary policy, I mean. They affect borrowing costs for individuals and businesses, and they impact spending and investment decisions. So when a central bank sets rates for other banks to borrow from them, they are effectively impacting interest rates for an entire economy. Second, bond prices play a crucial role in capital allocation, not only for the cost of borrowing for the government, but if bond prices are high, it becomes easier for these entities to raise capital, right? Which can lead to increased investment and economic growth. Again, bond prices high means interest rates low, the cost of servicing your debt goes down. If we are in the scenario where we're in now, right, interest rates become high, bond prices crash. That's a key point, which we'll come back to in a minute. Third, bond prices can also be an essential tool for risk management, as investors can use bonds to diversify their portfolios and mitigate risk. A diverse bond portfolio can provide investors with a steady stream of income as well as capital preservation, or at least it should provide a steady stream of income and it should provide capital preservation. And lastly, bond prices can serve as an economic indicator, providing insights into the health of the overall economy. For example, if bond prices are rising, it can indicate that investors are seeking safe haven assets, which may suggest that they are worried about the economy's outlook. Again, bond prices rising, interest rates falling. Okay. So what happened last year as the government was trying to slow down and reverse the pace of inflation? They raised interest rates. Okay. As they raised interest rates, the value of the bonds that most banks purchased fell in tune with the raising of the interest rates. Again, rising bond prices, falling interest rates. Raising interest rates, falling bond prices. So if you're invested heavily in bonds in a rising interest rate environment, you are most likely losing money. Now, there are ways to hedge that risk, but you have to do it. If you don't hedge, you suffer the losses. That is what happened last week, or actually over the last several months, at Silicon Valley Bank, as well as most large banks, actually large and mid-sized banks for that matter, in the United States. A report was released showing upwards of $700 billion of unrealized losses on banks holding long-term bonds. Why would a bank want to hold long-term bonds? Well, traditionally, holding long-term bonds is a very safe way, as I said, to preserve capital and generate income. Now, that's predicated on one thing. If you're taking customer deposits and putting them into these long-term bonds, your assumption is most customers won't be asking for their money back for quite a long time. Because if they do, you have to sell the bonds. But if interest rates skyrocket and you have to sell the bonds because customers want their money back, you have to recognize massive losses. That is exactly what happened at Silicon Valley Bank. They ended up with what we call a duration mismatch between customers wanting their money now and bonds being dated long into the future. Because banks are allowed to make the assumption that there won't be a run on their bank, they don't have to price the value of the bonds using today's mark-to-market. Mark-to-market is simply a fancy way on Wall Street of saying, what is the value of your asset right now? They can simply push out the value 20 years into the future for a bond that has a 20-year maturity, because they're allowed to make the assumption that nobody wants their money right now. If they had mark-to-market their bonds on a daily basis while interest rates were rising, it would have been obvious to everyone, including their shareholders, as well as the Feds, that they were having a solvency problem because there was a complete mismatch between the value of their portfolio and the value of customer liabilities, which represents their deposits. However, no one asked and no one told. Okay, this is happening with every bank in the world, just not happening to the same degree that it happened with Silicon Valley Bank. This forced the Federal Reserve, Treasury, FDIC to step in and say, if we don't backstop this unnecessarily risky behavior, this is going to create a mess, and it's a systemic issue for the entire banking system. And so they sent a very clear message that we will backstop long-term bond losses, because effectively we made you buy them in the first place is probably the undercurrent to why all of this was happening in the first place. Okay, that's the bond market. But as I said, this caused Silicon Valley Bank to fail. It had a secondary effect on Silvergate Bank. And then lastly, we had Signature Bank. Now, Signature Bank is interesting because, as far as we can tell, their actual insolvency was not clear. Right now, this is a bank whose, you know, $79 billion of their $88 billion in deposits were completely uninsured at the end of 2022. This is according to the New York Times. And as of last week, Signature said that more than 80% of its deposits were from law firms, accounting firms, healthcare companies, manufacturers, real estate companies. I think I read that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, used the bank and also helped finance President Trump's Florida golf course. Very diversified business, as far as I can tell. Now, when the FDIC was handed Signature over the weekend, our understanding is they were shocked. They were not expecting to be handed Signature Bank. The New York regulators stepped in and decided that Signature Bank represented a systemic risk to the entire banking system. This little mid-sized bank represented a systemic risk to the entire banking system. When regulators told bank executives, according to the New York Times, that they were effectively seizing Signature Bank, which had 40 branches across the country, they were shocked. Okay. And of course, the exec team is removed at the same time. If an exec team is shocked, right, it begs the question, why were they shocked? In general, the FDIC, when they seize a bank, seizes that bank either Thursday or Friday to do their jobs over the weekend. Okay, this happened long after that. It was either Saturday or Sunday when they seized the bank. Okay, so we'll come back to this. Nick and I are going to talk about it. Super interesting. So what does this mean for the crypto industry? Well, what it means is that it has now become significantly harder for companies servicing the crypto industry to actually maintain a bank account. Now, let me give you some background information. All right. This goes back to, 2013, I think it was. Let me find my notes here. There was a program, well-documented, you can find it on Wikipedia, called Operation Chokepoint. Operation Chokepoint was a program launched in 2013 by the United States Department of Justice, DOJ, and other federal agencies to investigate banks and financial institutions that were suspected of facilitating fraudulent activities. Okay. The program targeted industries with a high rate of customer fraud complaints, including payday lenders, debt collectors, gambling operations, retail firearms dealers. Now, it turns out that there was no fraud. The goal of the program was simply to cut off the perfectly legal bank access of these industries, right, again, to the entire banking system, by pressuring financial institutions to terminate or restrict their relationships with these businesses. Effectively, it was illegal coercive behavior on behalf of federal agencies to convince them to stop doing businesses with these banks, to effectively choke their point of access into the banking system. And the DOJ accomplished this by issuing subpoenas to banks, conducting investigations, using regulatory guidance to pressure financial institutions to cut ties with targeted industries. I can tell you, as somebody who ran a remittance business, money service business, where several of my peers lost their bank account access and had trouble helping immigrants to the United States send money home. And so obviously the critics of this claimed that it was an abuse of power that violated the due process rights of businesses and could have had a chilling effect on legitimate industries. And it turns out it did. In 2017, Trump ended the program, citing concerns about government overreach and the potential harm to legal businesses. And Congress did its own investigation and censured everyone involved, finding that the program was highly illegal and unethical for sure. Okay. So why am I telling you about a program that was started over 10 years ago? Well, it looks like Chokepoint is back and it is completely focused on the crypto industry. So to talk about Chokepoint, what it means for the banking industry, I interviewed Nick Carter from Castle Island Ventures. As I said, Nick has been a prolific speaker, writer on this topic. In addition to his day job of being a founding partner of Castle Island Ventures, Nick cares deeply about the crypto space, obviously because it affects the value of his portfolio. But independent of that, I do believe he, as a steward of crypto, truly believes in the future of decentralized systems. I've known Nick for a long time and have always found him to be very consistent in this belief. All right. So without further ado, let's get into my interview with Nick Carter. All right. So welcome, Nick Carter. Welcome to Money Talks. Thrilled to have you with us. Nick, you've been in the news quite a bit lately vis-a-vis your commentary on this whole kind of choke point bank de-risking discussion. Maybe for the uninformed here, and there's a lot of folks here who aren't in the thick of this like you are, could you just explain to us like how we got here in the first place and what you mean when you say choke point?
Sure thing. And thanks for having me back on the show, Bill. Always a pleasure to see you. I wish it was under more auspicious circumstances. What could I say? I've been asked to stop referring to it as Chokepoint 2.0 by certain folks in DC. I believe that Chokepoint 1.0 has some kind of like partisan overtones. But when I wrote the article about a month ago, that's what felt like the most appropriate comparison. So okay, what was Chokepoint? It was a program whereby it was mainly under the Obama administration, whereby financial regulators were deputized. They deputized the banks in order to marginalize specific industries, basically cutting off bank access for industries that they didn't like. Instead of going through the congressional route and passing a law, they did it in this kind of roundabout, a covert way. The bank regulators, primarily the FDIC and the OCC, they would go to banks and say, well, You shouldn't deal with these industries. They're high risk. And they were mostly referring to reputational risk. So they would invent this notion of reputational risk for particular industries, tell banks it was too risky. Then they didn't service them. Those industries suffered as a result. That was choke point 1.0.
So now I was in the remittance business at the time, and I had friends whose, you know, competitors, peers, whose businesses was effectively cut off because they couldn't use banks to settle, right? You use Western Union. What's actually happening is Western Union is just settling via the traditional banking system. And if they're debanked or unbanked, whatever you want to call it, you can't send remittances. Migrants can't send their money home. And a lot of people suffered. I mean, this was not just like some, you know, insider thing where somebody was getting even with somebody else. A lot of human beings suffered as a result of 1.0, to the point where we heard of deaths as a result of this, and I'm not making this up, right? So people like Somalia, for example, who were shut out from remittances because those companies were losing their correspondent bank access, had to stop sending remittances to those countries because those correspondent banks were telling their clients, stop servicing those markets or we will shut off your access. And obviously, a large bank or a mid-sized bank is not going to risk their correspondent banking access because one company wants to send a few thousand dollars in money transfers to Somalia, even though that might be somebody's lifeline.
Yeah. So it was a broad-based attack. It was, and it's very effective to weaponize the banking system. I mean, it's always been politicized. Finance has always been politicized to a certain extent, but it was to a certain extent a regime change, basically overtly deputizing banks to achieve policy objectives. The main sectors that were targeted were like not the most salubrious sectors, dare I say. I mean, we're talking about gun manufacturing, firearms, ammunition, the adult industry, payday lending. Nobody likes payday lending. So it's so it's kind of hard to defend these, but you do have to stick up for financial neutrality at the end of the day. Because if you can't trust the financial rails, then you just don't have a free society.
Yep.
That was 1.0.
Okay.
Fast forward. Trump administration largely puts an end to it. In fact, Brian Brooks, who was the comptroller, put in a, quote, fair access rule saying banks are not allowed to selectively service industries. They have to be impartial. On day one of the Biden administration under Michael Hsu, that was rolled back. Day one.
So that was not an interpretation of existing law. That was simply a regulatory policy that he created. Is that right?
That's right. Saying banks need to be impartial. And that changed. And things were okay for a while. And then, you know, crypto has always been marginal in terms of bank relationships. As you certainly have experience in 2015-16, whether you're able to get banking as a crypto company determined whether you succeeded or failed, basically. I mean, if you look back at the history of Coinbase, their relationship with SVB was critical to their success. SVB 100%. Did not want to bank them.
My understanding was is they didn't want to bank them, and it was Mark Andreessen from Andreessen Horowitz who basically called up the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank and said, hey, you want us as a client? You need to basically fix this. Now, I don't know if he worded it that way, but I'm guessing that was more or less how it was accepted by SVB, who then said, fine, but we're going to charge you an arm and a leg via all the compliance people that we're going to sick on you.
Yeah. And I've heard the same. And at the same time, you remember Circle got out of the business of running a Bitcoin exchange.
Right.
I believe a lot of that was due to their inability to get that kind of banking. So really determined, and this is important because this is where we're going to end up now, it determined who the winners and losers were.
That's right.
Whether you could get these tier one bank relationships. So that was the battle days. Then there were a few banks that started servicing crypto. Signature, Metropolitan, Silvergate, those were the main ones. There's a few others, but those are the sort of primary ones, and they made crypto part of their business. Then we had the glory days of banks supporting the crypto industry. They built fiat settlement networks like Signet and Sen, which allowed crypto firms to settle up fiat, to settle the fiat leg of the trade, and to have 24/7 fiat clearing to match 24/7 blockchain clearing, which is essential. However, in recent months, really over the last year or so, financial regulators in the US have turned the screw again and started issuing guidance, policy letters, blog posts, basically advising banks that to service crypto is to incur a risk, a serious risk, that you know, basically they're saying that the safety and soundness of banks is incompatible with servicing crypto clients. So it started as this messaging campaign. And then over since the turn of the year, just since 2023 began, the campaign escalated again to denying bank charters for crypto firms. So Custodia being the main one.
Yep.
You compare Custodia to the banks that have collapsed recently. Custodia was a fully reserved institution, no fractional reserve.
It's exactly what you would want to avoid the contagion in the first place.
And they were roundly denied by the Federal Reserve. Their application was denied. There were no issues with it. It was purely, they just didn't want a crypto bank to emerge. So some of us started to perk up our ears at that point, be like, okay, what's happening? Why is there so much hostility?
Yeah.
And then a bunch of joint statements came out. That's when I wrote the blog post in February, calling it Choke Point 2.0. I was pointing out that there was a pressure campaign to not only persuade banks, existing legacy banks, to not touch crypto, but also to stop any new crypto entrepreneurs creating new banks to fill that hole. Yeah. Of course, Silvergate had suffered a lot with their outflows. They were still alive. They were still alive a month ago. So they'd suffered a lot. They had a 70% drawdown. They'd survived that. You know, fast forward to a week ago, they collapse. There's big questions about that. We can dig into that. Surely thereafter, SVB collapses. That was the much bigger one. And then on Sunday, Signature is taken down. Whether they died by suicide or homicide, we'll also get into that. That's a very open question.
So a few things I want to double click on. So let's rewind for a second and let's talk about, you mentioned Signature providing services into the crypto community. You mentioned this product called Signet. You know, let's explain to people, why does a crypto company live and die, to your point about Circle earlier, why do they live and die via these relationships?
So generally speaking, exchanges or any businesses that are in that kind of business, they need access to the fiat system. It would be great if banks or if crypto firms didn't have this dependency, but ultimately you're dealing with fiat at the end of the day. Your customers want to withdraw fiat from the exchange. You have to pay people in fiat terms. As much as I wish we lived in this trustless crypto economy, that's not the world we live in. And then for market participants, arbitrageurs, market makers, exchanges, stablecoins, you also need this additional dimension of real-time fiat clearing and settlement. Especially if you think about a stablecoin, you might have some reserves that you're holding in order to honor withdrawal requests on the weekend when the banks aren't working or outside of banking hours. But if those reserves are exhausted, now you have people that are trying to redeem those stablecoins with you, the issuer, and you don't have fiat to give to them anymore. So you need some way to get fiat outside of those banking hours under the orthodox model where banks are open 9 to 5, five days a week.
Right.
Then you have these windows where things don't work and then stablecoins start to depeg. We've actually seen this. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, a big part of the reason why, that's just one example, but basically because blockchains are settling continuously, the legacy banking system doesn't do that. That's why initially Silvergate created the Silvergate Exchange Network. Signature created something very similar with Signet. Those are the counterparts. They allow the crypto economy, they allow the banking counterpart to the crypto economy to work synchronously with public blockchains.
Okay.
Those are two critical pieces of infrastructure. As of right now, my understanding is they're offline or either offline right now or going offline.
Yep.
Those have been eliminated as a consequence of the banking failures here.
Well, Silvergate's version is certainly dead. My understanding is Signet's is being, or the Signature one is being wound down because the bank wasn't completely shuttered because of the way the FDIC takes over, which I want to double click on next. Before we go there, you talked about the pressure. Now you've researched this, you've written about it, you've been interviewed about it. You must have started to work your way backwards to say, okay, this has to start somewhere. It just doesn't spontaneous. This idea of cutting off crypto company access to bank accounts doesn't spontaneously combust into existence. You work your way backwards there's somebody pushing some kind of button to say, this needs to happen, meaning these people need to be cut off, choked, or whatever you, however you want to refer to it. Did you work your way backwards, and what did you figure out?
Yeah, so the first thing that I tried to ascertain was, is it coordinated or not? Is it just happenstance that these banks are so what I noticed was a lot of banks were raising the threshold for onboarding crypto clients. Mm-hmm. It was still possible for crypto clients to onboard, but the banks would say, you need to be of a certain size. You need to be able to pass this level of advanced KYC, like much more compliance burden. A lot of our startups were telling us that too. So, you know, we have 70 portfolio companies, they would tell us this. Then I noticed all these regulatory guidance, these letters, they were coming out at the same time from multiple regulators. You'd have actions from the Fed, OCC, FDIC, literally every financial regulator and the administration. They would be, those actions would be announced on the same day within hours of each other. So I realized that there was a coordinated effort. So basically from there, I tried to figure out who the specific individuals were behind this. Turns out, as far as I can tell, the Biden administration, marginalizing the crypto industry is not actually a top level priority for them, believe it or not. It feels like that. We're sort of like in the thick of it right now. Yeah. It's not, if you ask Biden what his top 10 priorities were, yeah, crypto is actually not. It's right. Not one of them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you would have to wonder, like, okay, really? I mean, come on. You got Ukraine, you've got debt ceiling, you've got, you know,
climate is certainly one as well. Yeah. I mean, the industrial policy, like, there's a lot going on there. Crypto is actually an afterthought. However, I think what actually happened was Congress is now half, you know, the House is Republican controlled, the Senate is Democrat controlled. People realized post midterms that no congressional legislation was going to come through for the next 2 years, because basically it's hung, you know, it's split, and there's not a lot of acrimony, a lot of partisan divide in Washington. So there's going to be very little congressional regulation pertaining to crypto. A lot of people in Washington are hostile to crypto. They realized that route was not going to work. Yep. So then a lot of these regulators took it upon themselves to do something about crypto. Of course, we know the SEC has already been doing their thing on an ongoing basis. That precedes all this.
Yep.
What changed was some of these bank regulators, the entities that oversee banks, they started this concerted campaign. And the main antagonists, in my view, are the FDIC and the OCC. Those are the main ones. There's some other players like the National Economic Council, which is basically part of the administration, and the New York Department of Financial Services, which is really central to this story, especially with the signature element. But so those are the main entities, and they started acting in a coordinated manner. Initially, it was kind of a suspicion. It was a theory. Now we know that it's coordinated. We have enough information to know that for sure. And we know who the main individuals are that are orchestrating this. Actually, I haven't really said it anywhere. I don't want to invite a harassment campaign or anything. But as far as I can tell, it's Martin Gruenberg at the FDIC, who, by the way, presided over Chokepoint 1.0.
Right.
So he knows the playbook.
He was in a different agency then. I think it was DOJ, right? Or OCC.
I think he was actually part of the FDIC, but I have to double check.
Okay. Maybe I got it wrong. I was thinking of someone else. But yeah, I've heard this name mentioned a couple of times in this regard.
Certainly involved. And then Bharat Ramamurthy at the National Economic Commission or Council, which is basically part of the White House. And then Adrian Harris at the NYDFS. So all of these people have publicly been critical of crypto. They maintain a lot of influence, right? They can influence what banks do.
Right.
And as far as I can tell, those are the main folks that are really pushing for this effort to marginalize the crypto space and to basically cut it off from the financial system. And if you were to ask them, they would have answers. It's not just an arbitrary thing. They would tell you why they're doing this. It's because they believe that crypto is a systemic risk to the financial system. They believe that basically risks would be introduced into the traditional financial system via crypto. I would dispute that, frankly. Sure. I think if risks were to have been contagious, we would have seen it during the crypto collapse in 2022. The truth is we didn't see a lot of spillover effects, right?
Unlike, say, banks buying long-dated bonds in an environment of rising interest rates, which creates, you know, $1 trillion worth of unrealized losses in the banking system, which the taxpayer is about to, you know, cover.
They're going to socialize those. Yeah. So, I mean, now, post...
Wait a second. So now, I basically had a New Year's resolution, which was to, as a New Yorker, to kind of minimize my kind of sarcasm.
Right.
So I'm going to say this as with a series of faces as I can. This reeks of wag the dog BS in an environment where we basically have a banking crisis, which is going to rival the GFC, the great financial crisis of 2008, when TARP was negotiated down to $1 trillion. This appears to be bigger.
I mean, right. Objectively, yes. The Fed facility, they've said they have up to $2 trillion in dry powder to support the financial system. And TARP, I think, was $800 billion.
And yet we're talking about a few billion dollars worth of crypto transactions at mid-sized banks.
Yeah. If you're going to pin the blame on Silvergate, that was a $20 billion bank. So that's pretty small in the grand scheme.
And Silvergate's smallest business was crypto, as I understand it, right?
Because they weren't exclusively crypto. They weren't exclusively crypto.
Okay. Now, I don't know how much you know about this, but I want to come back to a couple of things you said. But one thing about the OCC, right? So under Brooks, who I think he's CEO of Bitfury now.
He's at Bitfury.
Yeah. A good guy from what I can tell, reasonable guy. He created a system that would allow bank charters or trust charters effectively, similar, not dissimilar to the Wyoming charter, with via the OCC. And I think Anchorage is the only company that managed to get one. And obviously, that path for coming into compliance is now shut off to the public.
And I'll add that Paxos and Protego, their applications for that charter are outstanding, and they've been outstanding for over a year now. Right. So that path has been, that was another thing I noted, that path is closed off.
Okay. And they've given no public explanation as to why they didn't charter two companies that already have trust charters via states. Right. Whereas Anchorage didn't even have one before. This was their first charter. It should have been easier to charter Paxos and any other company with a state trust charter via the OCC. Yet it's just sitting there on the shelf.
Yeah. So that's one very insidious thing is under normal market mechanisms, if things weren't clearing and banks weren't really filling this gap, then you could create a new bank and service the crypto industry in a better way, whether it's at the state level through the Wyoming SPDI or at the federal level through these charters, that avenue is walled off.
Okay.
So new banks, crypto-friendly banks, cannot be created under this current regime.
Okay. So now you mentioned Wyoming SPDI. Let's talk about Custodia for a second. So Custodia is a bank that was created in Wyoming a couple of years ago under this new special purpose depository institution charter. In English, that means they're supposed to maintain 100% reserves so that everything that happened to Silicon Valley Bank in theory cannot happen here because you're maintaining 100% reserves at all times, which means their revenue has to come from some other source, fees or whatever, okay? And yet this bank's access to the Fed or membership in the Fed was effectively denied in what Caitlin called publicly in a Twitter Spaces we did earlier this week, a totally coordinated effort amongst multiple agencies. Yeah. What is your take on that vis-a-vis the discussion we just had? Are they is it part of the same effort, or is it just a parallel effort that gets us to the same horrible place?
No, it's inherent. I mean, the Custodia denial was the first thing that really made me perk up and realize something bad was happening here, because they'd raised plenty of capital. They're extremely legitimate. They had the right stakeholders on board. And Caitlin had literally written the law, or at least contributed to writing the law in Wyoming. So there was no question about the legality or the compliance of this thing. And as you say, their business model was to hold full reserves in short-dated treasuries. Interesting tidbit on that. they were not proposing to be FDIC regulated because they wouldn't need depository insurance, right?
You don't need insurance if there's no chance of losing client money.
So they're actually responding in a sense that was more of a reaction to the first choke point where the FDIC was the vector of federal policy. So they were proposing to be state regulated, secure, not like a traditional bank, and they were totally shut down.
Yeah. I mean, if you know anything about banking and you're involved in any way in the system, I mean, this is outrageous. I mean, it's truly, you know, I don't want to say despicable because, you know, it's kind of a word on a spectrum, but outrageous in the sense of this affects every American who cares about the future of money and banking adversely in some way, because, you know, look, DeFi is going to be the future of banking, whether the bankers want it or not, whether the regulators want it or not. The question is, what is our place in that ecosystem? And are we just going to get leapfrogged and left in the dust? You know, if you've ever been to Singapore and ridden the subway, you know that New Yorkers were left in the dust because we were never able to modernize. And this feels like it's heading in that direction now. And you know, what are we supposed to do?
I mean, Custody, you're looking at a fundamental innovation in the business of banking, and especially contrasted with what we just saw, it's a more secure, safe, sound model. But because they were a crypto company, they were going to do business with crypto firms, they were walled out. Yep. So it is incredibly disappointing. It also means that now post-crisis, or actually we're in the crisis, but post the crypto banks being closed down or failing, there's not a lot of new banks that can emerge to fill the gap. We're going to have to look at the existing roster of banks and hope that they will find it sufficiently worthwhile to onboard crypto firms.
Right. What's interesting there is if I'm, you know, Wyoming regulator, or Senator Lemus from Wyoming, the governor of Wyoming, same in Washington State or in Texas, places where there is regulation, but they actually want to embrace this and enable it for the masses, they should be equally outraged because they have invested millions of dollars of their constituent tax money to create legal frameworks for being able to do this and are basically being shuttered by federal regulators without any viable explanation while they're bailing out banks for unnecessary risky behavior that's going to cost taxpayers $1 trillion, which has nothing to do with crypto, nothing other than we're talking about both of them at the same time. So I mean, as an American, it's just like, I sit here and watch this. I go, well, yeah, this is 2.0. I get why they don't want you to call it 2.0 because it hits too close to home.
Yeah. And it is a state's rights issue. Banks are allowed to be chartered by states or federally. If the federal government is going to say state charters are now not allowed, you're quashing an inherent power of the states. And if you look back at the banking history in this country, states have been tremendously important in bringing new banking institutions to bear, and they have that right to charter them themselves. So the federal government is now going to these states that are focused on innovation, new technology, focused on this new market segment, bringing in revenue to the state. The federal government is quashing them. That's a massive overstepping of the system we have here. It's not a purely mononodal system. Like, the states have rights that are enumerated in the Constitution, and those rights are being trampled.
So, okay, you're a founding partner of Castle Island. Great, you know, steward of the crypto space. You guys have a great portfolio. How has your portfolio, if at all, been affected positively or negatively by all of this?
Well, the first thing that I noticed was that our portfolio companies were struggling to get banking, especially after 2023 began, because banks themselves were raising the thresholds. They're making it much harder for startups. So that is one of the first chilling effects here, is that basically the outcome of all this is that for smaller, younger companies that touch blockchains in some way, you're at a disadvantage relative to incumbents. And we invest in startups, so we're betting on disruption. We're betting on new companies. That makes everyone's life harder, especially for the entrepreneurs. Now, for venture-backed companies, they are eventually able to get banking. But now with SVB not in the picture, it's going to be much more difficult. They're not going to get the same level of service. So basically, life is just harder for startups. The second thing I noticed is entrepreneurs that were going to start businesses that in some way depended on getting regulated, maybe getting a new bank charter, they just weren't doing that. So they would think about it and not do it because they saw what happened with Custodia. They realized that for the next 2 years, at least, it's not going to be a viable option to start that business.
Yeah.
And that is really disappointing. I don't blame them, but it's really disappointing because we're talking about new businesses that would otherwise be created, provide a valuable service to the market that aren't getting created.
Yeah.
So it's basically has had a massive chilling effect on the crypto industry.
So if you do some game theory on this, I guess two questions. One, what do you think is going to happen in kind of the short term, next few weeks and months, as it relates to this whole bank situation, as specifically for crypto, or if you want to talk about the broader market, that's fine. But I'm thinking specifically crypto. And is that the same as what you think should happen? And if not, what do you think should happen?
Well, regarding the sort of like bank crisis that we're in, I think most rational individuals will just withdraw their deposits from smaller banks, from community banks, and go to larger systemically important banks, which is pretty bad for society in a couple of ways. So first of all, it's just bad for the vibrancy and the competitiveness in the bank sector, which you know, smaller banks tend to lend to smaller companies, larger banks lend to larger companies. So it means that credit is going to be less available to smaller and medium-sized companies, which is just fundamentally bad for the economy. So, now that the Fed has stepped in, we're not going to see the bank runs happening the way that they did over the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
But it will be a slow bleed out of smaller community banks, and it'll lead to consolidation. And when you have consolidation, larger banks are able to extract more rent. So they're able to be much more onerous with regards to the firms that rely on them. So overall, it's just making the financial sector less vibrant and more intermediated. So that's just a general comment. Crypto firms themselves, they're scrambling. They're going from bank to bank. You know, they're being met with a lot of opposition. A lot of bankers that I've talked to tell me that they're being asked by their regulators to individually, on a per account basis, get permission to onboard new crypto clients. So that's like crazy, basically. You know, that adds so much overhead to what they do. So it means that they're only motivated to add a crypto focused company if the company promises to yield them significant amounts of revenue. And that means that they're biased towards larger firms. And so smaller firms, look, they'll be able to get, you know, there are about a dozen or so banks that still have some crypto practice that are quietly onboarding crypto businesses.
Yep.
But it just makes it much, much harder to get that reliable service, which you never, as a startup founder, that's never top of mind. You don't think to yourself, oh, you know, my business is going to depend on whether I get banking access. That was an afterthought. Now it's actually front and center, and it's another thing to worry about.
Yeah. So what do you think happens 6-12 months out? Do you think this, you know, people have a short attention span or memory and this just goes away? Do you think it goes away, rears its head again? You know, what do you put your, you know, look in your crystal ball, tell me what you think happens.
So in the short and medium term, one of the obvious effects is that because SEN and Signet are offline or going offline, it appears that FDIC won't allow Signet to be spun out to an acquirer for the signature assets. So those interbank clearing mechanisms won't exist. So that'll affect liquidity in the crypto markets. We've actually already seen it happen. Liquidity is degraded significantly on exchanges because it means that firms just don't have the confidence that they can clear the fiat leg of the transaction. So it's just harder to, you know, have margin on an exchange on the weekend. So that's one very immediate effect. More generally, the crypto industry is galvanizing a little bit. So they're getting a little organized. I mean, obviously, we took significant blows here, especially with the loss of Signature and Silvergate. And they are reacting a little bit. So we saw the Blockchain Association send out freedom of information requests to try and understand why Signature in particular was shut down. What was the thinking there?
Yep.
We had a hearing in the House Financial Services Committee last week or 2 weeks ago asking about Choke Point 2.0 specifically. A bunch of senators wrote letters to these agencies. So I think what you'll see will be more transparency around the decision making. And we'll also come to understand whether the decisions that were made were legal and procedurally appropriate, or whether they were arbitrary. And, you know, we don't have that many tools to tackle it. We basically have the House and we have the courts. So if I were a signature shareholder, I would be suing DFS, for instance, to determine was signature's closure, was that appropriate? I mean, if as Barney Frank, who's on the board, is alleging they were still solvent when they were shut down on Sunday, were there actually good reasons for DFS to send them into receivership with FDIC, or was it done out of a petty political opposition to crypto? These are the things that hopefully we will get answers to in the next few months.
Yep.
The other thing that's going to happen is I believe other banks will emerge to fill the gap here. So from conversations I'm having, there are bankers that are brave, that are willing to stick up for the industry, that are willing to onboard crypto clients, maybe even rebuild these pieces of infrastructure that have been destroyed. So I am somewhat optimistic around that. I think there's banks that will realize there's an opportunity here. Crypto industry is not going away, and they still need, you know, these kinds of service revision. So I do think that these wounds will be healed. But in the intermediate term, what we do need is answers as to whether these regulators have gone totally rogue off the reservation, or whether they're acting within the accepted rule set. I think it's way outside of the rules, but it'll be left to Congress to launch those investigations.
Yeah, I do expect a shareholders lawsuit for signature, even if it's just to find out what happened, because there's a major, I've never seen such a disconnect in the banking system before between one party saying we're solvent and the other party saying it's not an ongoing viable concern. And I think the FDIC themselves were surprised when it was laid in their laps on Sunday morning or whenever it was on that Sunday. They were not expecting it.
So yeah, that's what we're hearing.
For them to have zero visibility into a bank being laid in their lap over the weekend and say, here, fix this or take it on, is unheralded and unheard of in my 30 years, certainly. I haven't seen it.
This was a $100 billion bank. This was not a small bank. And crypto wasn't even their exclusive practice. Crypto was a smallish part of their business.
They were known for, right? Like New York real estate, you know? And so where are the people in New York real estate that did business with them to say, look, you know, we know this bank's financials and they were sound, you know?
And I'll add that on Saturday, after SVB had already collapsed, the sell side took a look at Signature's financials and they said, actually, Signature doesn't have the same issues that SVB had. They don't have the same amount of hold to maturity securities. They actually look somewhat solvent. They seem fine. Look, the sell side isn't, they've not, I don't have 100% forecasting record, but still, it did come as a shock to pretty much everyone. And when asked, the DFS said, well, we had a crisis of confidence in the bank's leadership. What kind of, I don't think that's like a real excuse to take down $100 billion bank, vaporize $7 billion of shareholders' equity. I don't think that's a sufficient justification.
And you also have a New York AG who's already on your side. So you have many vehicles and means by which you can go after the bank that don't involve, you know, shutting out the shareholders. It doesn't make any sense. If it's insolvent, I get it. It is what it is, right? Shareholders took a risk. They lost their money. But if the bank is not insolvent, you know, where does the FDIC's authority stop and start as it relates to shareholders' rights? And I don't know that that's been tested in the courts, but I have a feeling it's about to be.
Yeah. And actually, if you look at the various crypto cases, they're making their way through the courts. Generally speaking, the crypto industry is doing fairly well in those cases. You look at the SEC's cases against Ripple, SEC against Voyager or Binance US for the Voyager assets, SEC versus Grayscale. The judges are actually pretty sympathetic because in many cases, we are dealing with overstepping regulators.
That's right.
So the courts are inclined to put them in their place a little bit. So that will be one avenue where we learn the truth eventually.
That's right.
It's just, it takes forever to play out.
Well, they've relied historically, I guess, through the first gen of crypto on startups not being able to afford to fight. Then you had Ripple that was flush with cash, Grayscale flush with, well, at least the Grayscale piece of the business, enough cash to fight.
Right.
Custodia claims, Caitlin has claimed publicly they have enough money to fight. So you've backed the proverbial cat in the corner, and it's, you know, what does a cat do when it's backed in a corner? It doesn't whimper away like a dog. It will scratch your eyes out. And I think that you've backed the cats into the corner at the same time, and they're just going to scratch your eyes out.
Yeah. And I expect some of these cases will go to the Supreme Court, because we're dealing with real constitutional issues, like especially on the state charters, which is, can the federal government disallow a whole class of chartered banks from coming into existence? I don't think so. The Constitution, there's a whole amendment on that. Okay. Right. The states have genuine rights on this stuff. And if I were, part of one of those states that's being shut down, I would have real questions about this.
I agree. So I foresee that as well. And, you know, I have kind of an overarching view on this, which is I lived in Europe for many years in my 20s during my Netscape days. I would go back and forth. So I get to understand contract law there, because I was doing agreements in both places. And what you come to understand in places like Germany or France, they explicitly allow things. And in the US, we explicitly disallow things. Meaning the implication is if the government tells you that doesn't tell you can't do something, you're allowed to do it. That is the basis for contract law and the constitutional system we have in the United States. Our constitution is a list of exceptions. Okay. It means you have unlimited rights except for these things. You will be governed by 50 senators, et cetera, right? Or 100, however many senators, 100 senators, right? And in Germany, you know, you have to explicitly allow something, right? And so in a model where everything is legal unless a law is passed that says you can't, and then it has to fit within the exceptions of the constitutional framework, clearly there is overreach here, because you're dealing with laws that in many cases were written in between 1900 and 1940, predating television, the internet, and certainly blockchain. Not to mention smartphones and a few other technologies that are involved. So obviously there weren't laws prohibiting those things, because those things didn't exist. So at some point it has to go to the Supreme Court, because there has to be a basis upon which you can disallow something which isn't stated in a law somewhere.
Yeah. Right. You strike on an excellent point, which is underappreciated, is common law versus civil law. And, there's a great study called Law and Finance, which is one of my favorite papers of all time, which looks at capital market formation, the size of capital markets relative to GDP, finds that in common law countries, it's far greater than in civil law. So Germany, you know, very wealthy nation, relatively underdeveloped equity markets compared to the US. The US is about 25% of global GDP, 40% of public market capitalization. So as you say, common law lends itself to innovation, to formation of companies, and to the ability to list those companies on public markets. And that's one of our greatest strengths as a nation. I mean, the financial markets that we have here. What's happening right now is those financial markets are being deputized by the government to crush a specific industry. It's antithetical to what made America good and to what made it a safe place to put your assets. It's very arbitrary, and it calls into question the entire structure of the financial market if we allow this kind of political arbitrariness to dominate.
Right. I think Ayn Rand wrote a couple of books about this. Mm-hmm. So first of all, this has been awesome. Our 15-minute conversation turned into 50, which the time flew by. So hopefully people appreciate the importance and complexity of these topics. To me, it's somewhat black and white at the highest layer. But when you double click and try to defend yourself, which is what we're forced to do, it becomes very complex. So I there's so many other things that I want to dig into here. So are you of the opinion that a lot more details are going to come out vis-a-vis other parties? Are you sitting on information that you think the public is going to find out about? I mean, do you think this gets worse in that regard, or do you think it's out there already, what needs to be out there?
We have very little information about what's happening, and we're trying to piece it together. It's like, you know, building a mosaic. And I don't have a lot of info. I'm just going based on what informed parties are telling me. I am working on a sequel to my Choke Point article, basically to summarize what's going on and lay out the kind of crypto view, the crypto interpretation of the bank crisis, which is a very different interpretation from what we're seeing in the press, basically. And I think these questions need to be asked. Specifically, I have questions on Silvergate's collapse. So the withdrawal of their federal home loan bank facility, there's significant questions over whether that was done with a political motive, because that was the immediate trigger of their collapse, yep. was having to pay back that $4 billion. I have questions about that, which we need answers to. On SVB, I don't have as many questions because they weren't really a crypto institution. I think they just really did collapse in a sort of classic bank run. And then Signature, of course, huge outstanding questions on the motives of DFS for putting them into receivership,
yep.
whether Barney Frank's allegations are true, and you know whether the bank was shuttered because they were running Signet, and why and if Signet is being excluded from the acquisition conversations, which it appears to be the case. So, and whether they were solvent. So there's, you know, it'll come out eventually, right? These things can't not come out. The government has to respond to these information requests. I've heard that there are inquests at the federal level and at the state level as a consequence of the Signature thing. So it is partly just going to be a matter of time and sitting on our hands and waiting. But I think we also have enough information to know that federal regulators took advantage of a banking crisis, may have even instigated a banking crisis in order to get at the crypto industry. That got way out of control. Now it's a global banking crisis affecting Europe, Credit Suisse. So I think it got way out of hand. But I do believe it was, if not instigated to go after the crypto industry, certainly taken advantage of to take down these crypto banks. And you know, that, if true, is profoundly perturbing. But I think it is. And in the coming weeks and months, we'll find out.
Wow. Nick Carter, you're awesome, man. Thank you for, you know, what you're doing for the space and for all of us to get the word out and put yourself out there. I'm sure a lot of the blowback can't be fun, but we, you know, I'm speaking for behalf of everyone, but I know that many of us really appreciate what you're doing. We know it can't be fun. We know it's necessary, and you know, you've got a portfolio to protect. You know, you're not just doing this for your health, and you know, I'm praying and hoping that two things happen. One, some sanity comes back into the system in terms of understanding free businesses and what their rights are, and legal businesses. And two, that I think DeFi and other technologies will force their hand to say, hey, look, this is going to happen anyway, and we either need to be part of it and figure it out, or you know, the migration is just going to continue. So. Thank you so much for giving us the time. It's fascinating.
It's been my pleasure. It's always a great pleasure to chat with you, Bill. So thanks for having me on.
Thanks, brother. And I look to see you in Miami very soon when I escape the rain we're having here in Silicon Valley, regardless of what my background says. All right. Thanks again, Nick. Good to see you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Thanks to Nick Carter for that amazing, amazing discussion. Nick was absolutely on fire. I hope you enjoyed that. It was very sobering, kind of a, not somber, but sobering is probably the right word. Look, you know, those with absolute power, I think, corrupt absolutely. I think we need to be very sensitive to the power of decentralization, what Bitcoin and Ethereum represent. They represent giving power back to the people over the monetary system, over giving power back to the people in terms of how the banking system itself should work. And we need the on-ramps and off-ramps into the old system to work for us in order to build the new system. And we all need to demand from our congresspeople, our regulators, our bankers, that they enable the kind of legal services that we want to build a better future. And I strongly believe that. Okay, let's talk about crypto. So I'm going to share my screen here. Let's get right to the chart. Super interesting what's going on. Bitcoin spiked last week, or a few days ago, I should say, based upon you know, the current events, it appears. So last, was it Sunday, in the midst of this banking crisis, Bitcoin spiked 7.5%. Monday, another 9%. Tuesday actually was up probably another 8%. And then fell back down to close up 2%, and now is over 25K as of my recording here, and it looks poised to continue its run. Volume has been good, so let me see if I can get this to work here. How do I do that? Anyway, so the volume has actually been increasing as well, which is super interesting. We can look at Ethereum. Ethereum broke out, fell back down. It is at the top of its 3-month range, right at near 1700, a little under 1700. I expect Ethereum will, it always trails Bitcoin on these run-ups and then has its day and then outperforms Bitcoin. So if this time is no different, let me close this. You know, I expect Bitcoin, Ethereum, to break out of its range over 1800, probably in late March, early April. We'll see. Could happen faster. I mean, this run up here on Sunday and Monday of, what was it? 3.5%, 7%, another 5%, another 2%. I mean, that was all in 4 days. And that took us from a low of during the initial bank contagion of 1450 all the way up to 1780 or almost 1800. And I do expect us to retest 1800 in the coming days and next few weeks. So really bullish on the crypto front. Crypto is clearly outpacing right now. Let's take a look at the dollar. Dollar strengthened on Wednesday. I don't see, I don't know why it's updating right now. Let me try to, yeah. So it looks like, I think the dollar is going to retest the lows. It certainly strengthened the last couple of days, but I think what's going on is it's relative to the fact that they're raising interest rates right now in Europe, which I think has a lot of people scared, right? So we'll come back to the dollar. Let's take a look at the S&P, right? So the S&P did recover on Thursday. It's been in a downtrend since early February. And let's see, let's take a look at the Dow Jones, mostly up this week, although again, mostly sideways, not back in the uptrend. So Bitcoin is actually outperforming everything right now, maybe with the exception of gold. Let's take a look. Gold is, it's pretty much about to make a new swing high versus the February highs of 180 in the Spider Gold Trust here, which I think is 10 to 1. So that would put gold at about $1,800. If I understand gold correctly, I don't track gold too often. Let's see what else we want to take a look at. Let's take it to QQQ right now, which is the NASDAQ 100. Where is that? I know it's here somewhere. Here we go. All right. So you can almost think of Bitcoin right now as a levered bet on tech stocks. And we can see here, in the last few days, the NASDAQ 100 was up 2.5%, 0.5%, 2.6%. So it's had a really good week. And as we would expect, Bitcoin outperforming that as well, as it has done traditionally over the last few years. Okay. So I suspect that to continue. I think tech stocks are going to have a good run the next few months. I think the monetary tightening is done. I think that we are headed for more quantitative easing in order to stem the bank contagion and any effects of that. I'll stop this. Lynn Alden had a really interesting post on Thursday about this topic. I'll try to find it for you. But basically, the gist of it was, as I said, the monetary tightening is basically done. But she says that the fear here, or the fear should be, that because we are still in an inflationary environment, that it is a problem for the Fed. But I'm not so sure I agree with that. So let me see if I can find this here. So here we go. Share. Here is the total assets, less eliminations from consolidation. And here you can see where the repo spike began. And here, and this was back in 2020. And here we can see where the bank run started a couple of weeks ago. And now you can see there's a little blip here where it looks like while we had tightening, we're now back into easing mode. Right, the Fed has some flexibility on interest rate decisions, but they've basically run into the liquidity floor hard. That part I agree with for sure. She said last week, I think the Fed is close to being done quantitatively tightening. That doesn't mean rate cuts or anything like that, but it seems like the balance sheet drawdown is likely to end prior to rate cuts being initiated. That part is actually very clear to me. And so I do think we're probably, 100 to 180 days away from the first bout of rate cuts. Could come sooner if the bank contagion spreads, but the Fed's new facility can loan up to $2 trillion. That's true. It's not an active decision to lend that much, but the money is there. How big it gets will depend upon whether the Fed tries to keep draining its assets or not. Either way, flat to up balance sheet for now. Totally agree. Okay, so it does look like quantitative tightening is done. We are back to quantitative easing. And as I said, it's probably game on for risk on assets after that. Okay. So it was an interesting week. We talked about bank failures. We talked about the Fed. We talked about bond markets and why they mattered vis-a-vis these bank failures. We talked about some crypto news, another crazy week in the kind of crypto news front. Most of the stories have been related to this bank issue and bank de-risking issue, and also the fact that Bitcoin is on the move. By the way, the Ethereum Shanghai hard fork, it has an official target date of April 12th, so less than 1 month from now. The Shanghai hard fork basically enables staking withdrawals on the Ethereum network. I think that could have very short-term downward pressure on the Ethereum price, or maybe if in the case of a Bitcoin run-up, could keep Ethereum held back a little bit while this is happening. Although I do suspect that enabling real-time withdrawals will probably have a long-term upward effect on the price of Bitcoin, because people will not be afraid to lock up their Ethereum if they think they can get it out anytime they want. Now, for Abra users who are using staked Ethereum, please keep in mind that you will not be able to withdraw your Ethereum right away. It will take time for the smart contracts to enable unlocking. And I think they do it on like a rolling basis. And so you kind of have to get in line, as I understand it. I'll try to cover that in more detail either next week or the week after on Money Talks. Okay. So that's big news. Ethereum Shanghai upgrade to enable withdrawals of staked Ethereum. So if you're interested in staking your Ethereum, now you don't have to worry about whether you can get your Ethereum out of the contract. It is now there for you to, or will be there for you to withdraw, and is a much safer way because you know you have access to your Ethereum when you need it, or you will after the upgrade. All right. Stable coins have been in the news a lot lately, partially because of this issue with the bank runs. USDC depegged last week. It went down to, I think, about 87 cents on the dollar. Almost immediately recovered within 48 hours, right? The system worked really well. As soon as everybody realized that the money was totally there, that there was just unnecessary fear in the system, USDC repegged one-to-one to the dollar to Tether and is now functioning as normal. We took USDC withdrawals offline for a couple of days. Everything's back online now. We did that out of an abundance of caution to make sure everything was working correctly. And it is now working correctly. So well done to the Circle team on managing this. That was through no fault of their own. They've done a really good job of spreading their assets around to multiple banks. They work with very reputable banks like BNY Mellon, for example, Goldman Sachs, and others. And they did have a small amount of money at SVB. But honestly, as of 3 weeks ago, everybody would have said, SVB, that's fantastic. They're a great bank, because nobody expected SVB to fail by buying bonds. Okay. All right. So that's that. And a lot of commentary in traditional and crypto media about crypto's role in these bank failures. It is 100% clear when you dig in that crypto had nothing to do with any of this. And the fact that it's even being discussed or mentioned is absolutely ridiculous. So I'm not going to spend a lot more time on it because I don't want to give it more face time, except to say, if you're hearing that, you should call BS and you should ask people for proof, because the proof doesn't exist, because it just didn't happen. All right. This is all about traditional financial risk management. If you are holding funds that are available on demand and on demand deposits, and you invest those funds in long-dated investments that go out 20 years, and the value of those investments fall, which is what happened with these bond investments, you have a big problem. And obviously, that has nothing to do with crypto, okay? So that's it, plain and simple. All right, so let's see. I'm going to stop there, I think. It's been a crazy few days, and we're all kind of exhausted in my world. And look, we're still here. We're not going anywhere. Our businesses are open. Institutional clients, retail clients, high net worth clients, we're here to serve all of you. You know how to find us, all right? You can download our app on the retail side. You can call up your sales rep on the high net worth side. Give us a ring on the institutional side. Our OTC desk is here to help. Our app is fully functional for trading, for borrowing against Bitcoin and Ethereum. And let us know how we're doing to help you and what else you want to see. We did a demo this week for the Abra team on Thursday of an amazing new service that we're going to be launching probably around April 2nd or so. I think April 3rd is that Monday. So I think we're going to launch that week if everything works out. It is amazing, and it's one of the best things we've ever built. And so you're really going to like it. And can't wait to show it to you in the next couple of weeks. We'll probably show it to you the week before, just so you can get a preview of what's coming. All right. So with that, I'm going to say thanks again to Nick for joining us on Money Talks. Thanks to our great team in the background making Money Talks happen. And with that, we will see you next week. Have a great weekend. Stay safe, and we'll see you soon.